I understand in life how it is that many of us strive to look to and wonder about where do I belong as far as, does God have a purpose for my life? Is there a purpose? Or is there a plan for me? And in different stages of life, that may hit you differently. Sometimes you're just too busy to think about it or too jaded to care. But many times throughout life, we're in seasons where we're wondering, is there a plan and a purpose for me? When I was a teenager, Michael W. Smith came out with this red-hot new album, Go West, Young Man, which was so cool at the time, but it sounds very 80s-ish right now when I listen to it in hindsight. Like most movies from the era that were cool, but all seem old. Anyhow, in his album, he had a song that was popular. One of the lyrics said, "I'm looking for a reason, roaming through the night to find my place in this world." And so it's such a relatable thing for so many young people and old people. Just say, what about me? Do I have a place? Do I have a purpose? Is there something that I'm making a mark, leaving something behind? Or what am I doing? Am I affecting things for the good? What is it about me? And does God have a purpose for my life? As believers, as Jesus followers, we might say things like, God, can you use me? Will you use my life? Even though maybe I don't think I'm as gifted or as special as somebody else, but do you have a plan for me? When I think about that a little bit before we're done today, we're continuing our journey through the Bible, and we've started last year. We've made it into the kings of Israel. We've been talking about the kingdom divided, and up in the northern kingdom, we met a king named Ahab and a queen named Jezebel who were terrible, and we saw Ahab's death a couple weeks ago, and then we spent a week in the south last week. Today, we're going to take a detour away from the kings themselves, but stay in the era. If I were to take a couple weeks off from the kings and come back to them in the near future. But I want to talk about some other characters, because when Ahab and Jezebel were running or ruining things up north, there was a prophet, several prophets of God, but one notable one named Elijah, that God seemed to raise up voices that were needed when they were most needed. And he raised up an Elijah to be a light in that dark time. And then others like Micaiah, who we met a couple weeks ago, and other people as well. And Elijah did some great things. We saw his showdown on Mount Carmel. He was a prophet. There were other prophets. And when you use the term prophet, it's a big word, to blanket what some people might call terms like clairvoyant today or something like that. People who can see the past or the future or something that they were there for and understand it and speak into it. And, of course, there were prophets, and there were prophets of the Lord, prophets who spoke on behalf of God and who had that clarity to give a message from God. And you see that there were several of them in the days of Elijah. But Elijah was different than others, because he not only was a prophet or a prophet of the Lord, but he was also a miracle worker. He didn't just prophesy or see things or tell things or predict things or whatever or give messages. He saw the fire from heaven on Mount Carmel. He saw the drought and the ensuing monsoon that came a few years later through his prayers and other things that he did. So he had a little extra something going on, but there were other prophets around. Anyhow, we met him, and then we saw him go through a season of burnout, bad burnout, and God brought him through that time and gave him a protege, gave him a young man that he could pour into named Elisha. Thank you for naming them so similarly so we can get them confused. Elijah and Elisha, two different people, but they sound so much alike. But anyhow, these two men, mentor-protege relationship as a prophet. And then there were others as well. And we kind of met them a little bit. And we're going to spend time in that zone for a couple of weeks, because we're going to leave the political landscape of the kings behind and go to the spiritual landscape of the prophets. There's a lot going on that's recorded in that time of history. Today, we're going to pick up the story where Elijah's life comes to an end down here, and he passes on, and then we're going to see Elisha's continue. And we'll see two stories. We're going to begin in 2 Kings chapter 2 and verse number 1. It says, "When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were traveling from Gilgal." The first thing I would point out to you here is that Elijah's going to have a pretty super, a special exit, which we've seen a couple times in stories of the Bible, like the story of Enoch back in Genesis. Even Moses had a bit of a unusual record of his ending. And Elijah's going to have this noteworthy moment of his departure. And it says that when the Lord's about to take him, that he's traveling one day with his young protege, Elisha, who's been working with them for years. We met Elisha briefly last week in a story that I told but kind of skimmed over. We mentioned him as well there. We met him a few weeks ago when Elijah first chose him. Elijah and Elisha are going along, and Elijah, as a prophet, he has that insight, that clarity to know what's about to happen. He knows that he's about to be finished down here. And so he's aware, but Elisha's still with him. So what happens next in verse 2, Elijah said to Elisha, "Hey, stay here, for the Lord has told me to go on to Bethel." So he doesn't say why. He doesn't say, "Hey, here's what's up." He just says, "Why don't you stay here? I got to go on. I got some more things to do today." He just wants to kind of leave him behind because of what's coming. And he knows it. But Elisha replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will never leave you." In other words, Elisha says, I also, he's not saying it out loud, but he knows what's going on. He's a prophet. He has the same clarity. And he knows what's happening that day. He knows this is the end. So without anyone saying what's up, he just, "Why don't you stay behind? No, I'm going to stick with you as long as you're living." Okay. So they went on together to Bethel. Now, when they get to Bethel, what's going to be interesting there is at Bethel, there is a gathering of people who were prophets, a group of prophets, or some translations call it a school of prophets, in Bethel, and also in another city like Jericho, and maybe many others, is places where people who were prophetic would live together, work together, grow in their trade or their giftings together, kind of like the Hogwarts of prophets, right, or something like that. I don't know if that's a, but no, but kind of gathering of, not Hogwarts, I can't believe you said that. Like a monastery of people, or a college of people trying to train for ministry, or whatever you want to say. They're gathering together, and they're going to have a place where they learn, they actually serve. The term later is that they served Elijah and eventually Elisha. Not in the sense that they were slaves, that's not what it means, but as they were being mentored and they were being poured into within their giftings and their calling, they would repay it through what they would follow their lead and do what was asked of them. And so they're going to go to Bethel to this place, the school, this group of prophets are there. And in verse 3, it says, "The group of prophets from Bethel came to Elisha, and they asked him, 'Did you know that the Lord is going to take your master away from you today?'" This is interesting. They know. They're prophets. They have this ability to see. But they don't know if Elisha is, because no one's talking about it. So they're like, "Hey, Elisha, I mean, we're aware. Are you aware that... I just think you, if no one's told you, if God's not made it clear to you, we've been given a vision that God's taking Elijah from you. This is the end of the road for him down here. Are you aware?" And Elisha replies to them. He says, "Of course I know, but be quiet about it." In other words, yeah, we know, but he's not really saying it. I'm not really saying it. It's kind of like the elephant in the room. So we're just kind of going with it, okay? So yes, I'm aware. Thank you. Now, what we just read in those first few verses repeats itself a couple more times. So when I read this repeat in a moment here, you won't think that we're just, it's the same story, but it happens a couple times more in a different place. So let's keep going. Verse 4. "Then Elijah said to Elisha, 'Stay here. Stay here in Bethel, for the Lord has told me to go to Jericho.' But Elisha replied again, 'As surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will never leave you.'" Same story. So they went on to Jericho. Then the group of prophets from Jericho came to Elisha, and they asked him, "Hey, did you know the Lord is going to take your master away from you today? Everyone seems to know this." "Of course I know," Elisha answered, "but be quiet about it." And then, here, this sounds familiar, verse 6, then Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, for the Lord has told me to go to the Jordan River." But again, Elisha replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will never leave you. As long as you're living, I'm standing by you." So they went on together. And now they come to the Jordan River. And it says in verse number 7 that 50 men from the group of prophets also went and watched from a distance as Elijah and Elisha stopped beside the Jordan River. So as they go along, the other prophets aren't invited into the journey, but they want to see what's going to happen because they know something's going to happen. So they're walking from a distance behind. and they see Elijah and Elisha going off into the sunset, so to speak. And they come to the Jordan River. And the Jordan River is a special place. Now, it was a place. It was always there. It's like any landmark, it becomes old hat when you're always by it. But the Jordan River had significance in a way that's going to be manifested in just a moment here once again. It has significance to the Israelites, and I think it has significance to Elijah. Something about Elijah and his journey, that he had these moments where God brought him back to landmark historical spots of his power when he was encouraging Elijah. Let me remind you, a few weeks ago when we saw Elijah going through burnout and he was ready to be done, that God brought him. He had served the Lord and he felt like he failed. And God brought him in his burnout to Mount Sinai on a journey, which is the same place centuries before where God had met Moses, when Moses was also feeling like he failed in Egypt at his first go and was in an exile. And God appeared to him there and said, go back into Egypt. I have a purpose for you still. And go back and lead my people from slavery. And it was at the same Mount Sinai where God would later give the commandments or the laws to Israel, because they did not have to govern themselves as slaves, but now they needed laws. So God gave them laws at Mount Sinai. And God brought Elijah there during his burnout to replenish him, not just at a special place, but at a special place for him with spiritual, historical significance to say, I'm still working today in you like I have before. And now they're at the Jordan River, and Elijah's getting ready to leave. And Elisha's, and no matter how powerful or spiritual we make these people, that kind of a change, passing to the other side is always, you know, it's a big step. It's a bit frightening, right? I mean, you know, I know, you know, people say all the time, I've got faith in God. I'm going to go to heaven someday, but I'm not in a hurry to take the next train to get there either, you know? And so Elijah's, now he's at the spot. It's a big moment. And they're at the Jordan River, and this is also a place of historical significance. It's the second body of water that God used as the Israelites came out of slavery. And they, at first, they had to leave Egypt, and they were chased by the Egyptians to the edge of the Red Sea, and God parted the waters, and they crossed on dry ground. And then 40 years later, when Moses was done, as he stayed behind to die, as Joshua led the Israelites into the land of Canaan, they came to the Jordan River, and to show that God's power was carrying on, he parted those waters once again, and they crossed on dry ground. And now Elijah and Elisha are standing at the Jordan, and it's time for the crossing of the Jordan. What do you do? Find a boat, hire him, swim really well because it's a strong river. What do you do? And in this moment, Elijah once again finds in his journey God's power. In verse 8, it says, then Elijah folded his cloak together and he struck the water with it. And the river divided, and the two of them went across on dry ground. Once again, just like in times past, God says, I'm still with you in this journey, including at the end of this journey. And they cross on dry ground. When they came to the other side, Elijah said to Elisha, tell me what I can do for you before I'm taken away. It's interesting because they've both known what's going on, but no one's been talking about it. But now in this moment, Elijah's like, okay, guy, you're here, so we must both know this is the end of the road for me, and you're still here, so I'm about to go. Let's just talk about it now. What can I do for you before I go? What do you want? And Elisha says something very interesting. Elisha replied, please let me inherit a double share of your spirit and become your successor. What a strange statement, and there's been a lot of theological speculation about this, you know, through the years of the Christians. A double portion of your spirit, what does that mean? And some people have historically stated, and I don't care about the nuance, but I'll point out a little bit of it for those of you who do. Some have argued that he was saying, I want a double portion of the Holy Spirit. You know, the Holy Spirit, his presence in our life, is referred to in the Christian writings that Jesus, when he died for our sins and rose again, said, I'm going to leave and I'm going to send a comforter to guide you, the Holy Spirit, to indwell you. He'll indwell you as believers, and he'll fill you as you make yourself available to do so, to fill your life and use you. But in the times before Christ, in the Old Testament writings, you'll see the Spirit of God came upon people for special callings and purposes, and men like Elijah and Elisha experienced that. So it might be easy to look at this and say, he's saying, I want a double portion of the Holy Spirit. Others would say, push back and say, that's not what he's saying. He doesn't ask for the Holy Spirit. For one, how do you have a, if you're filled with the Spirit of God, how do you have double of that? I mean, you know, if something's full, it's full. You fill a glass of water and you double fill it, it's just going to make a mess. So that doesn't make sense. Plus, whenever God's Spirit is referred to, it's referred to as the Holy Spirit or God's Spirit or the Spirit of God or the Spirit of the Lord or capital S Spirit. In this case, he says, I want a double share of your Spirit. So that's something different. So he's saying, I want a bigger container to, a bigger capacity to serve the Lord with. I don't know. And I don't, honestly, I spent so many years of my life in a group of Christians who argue about the nuances of theology with hard Hebrew translations and stuff and, you know, dividing over things that we can't possibly be positive about. I don't care. What I understand from this passage more than anything is this, that Elisha was saying, you're about to leave and you're a rock star. I would sure like to know that God has plans for me too and that he could use me as well in a mighty way. I hope that God can use my life in a big, in fact, I could double share. Can God do that and more with me? He's not asking, of all the things he could have asked for, you know, like, what do you want before I go? Oh, is this a genie in the bottle moment? Well, since you're leaving and our little company's breaking up, I'd like to cash out my 401k and live rich the rest of my life. He doesn't ask for money. He doesn't ask for fame. That's not a fame request for, we're going to see that later. I'll mention that later. But also, fame for a prophet was more like infamy back then. Like, Elijah spent most of his life running from Jezebel and Ahab at times because they wanted to kill him. Micaiah, the prophet, was in prison for saying the truth. You know, like, what kind of fame do you want? Elijah wasn't asking for fame or fortune. He was saying, I want to know that God can do something with my life the way he has with your life for the rest of my days. I want a double share of that. Whatever that means, whatever that translates to be, I want God to work through me. And Elijah says to him in verse 10, you have asked a difficult thing. Like, wow, could you just have asked for a puppy? I could have just, you know, I don't know. You've asked a difficult thing, he said. If you see me when I'm taken from you, then you'll get your request. But if not, well, then you won't. I can't guarantee that. So when I go, if God gives you some special insight into seeing what you would not otherwise see, then you'll get your request. And again, if not, that's okay, because you're already a prophet. You already have a good life in front of you still. I've already prepared you, so if not, oh well, go serve God your way. But if you're asking for something special, I can't promise that. Let's see what happens. Verse 11 says, as they were walking along and as they were talking, suddenly a chariot of fire appeared, drawn by horses of fire. Da, 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 da. I'm sorry, I just always think about that whenever I see that. Chariot of fire. All right. Anyway, the chariot of fire appears, drawn by horses of fire. It drove between the two men, separating them. And Elijah was carried by a whirlwind into heaven. Can we just stop here and say, that's pretty sensational. All of a sudden, a blur, a line between this world and the spiritual realm was, the line was crossed. It's interesting because we don't always know what, when we leave this life behind and we cross into, even if we have faith in God of the afterlife that's coming, it's still uncertain. That's why we're not usually trying to catch the next train across, you know, because we may have faith, but that valley of the shadow of death is still so uncertain, right? And so as we think about crossing over, there are people, in fact, some of us are in a group where we're reading through a book about documented cases of thousands and thousands and thousands of people who've had near-death experiences and have died for some period of time, come back and have visions, and how they all, so many of them correlate on the major touch points of what they see and experience. And the interesting thing is that we don't in this life see what's beyond. But in this moment, Elisha, who's not dying, is given a glimpse into the other realm. Elijah doesn't go. He gets to see Elijah in a spiritual way. Like things that you wouldn't see of what happens on the other side of what we see. He sees him carried away into heaven. And for Elisha, that's just a shocking and amazing thing for a mere mortal to see in this life. It says, Elisha saw it and he cried out, my father, I see the chariots and the charioteers of Israel. And as they disappeared from sight, Elisha tore his clothes in distress. And that's interesting. Why would he tear his clothes in distress? That was a pretty cool thing. I mean, wouldn't you argue? Wouldn't we make the case that he should be happy? I mean, after all, he was told if he saw something that special, that meant that God was going to answer his special request. So that's a positive. And also, he just got to see something that we all would love to see, just proof of something beyond this life, something bigger, something beyond. He saw it. I mean, shouldn't he be in a good spirit right now? But instead, he as he disappears, he tears his clothes in distress. Why? I just want to offer this thought to you this morning. And maybe you can relate to this. It doesn't matter how much hope or faith we have in what comes next or how sure we are that we have loved ones that we will see again one day. It's still hard to see them go. It's still hard to see them taken. Doesn't mean that we're not happy or don't we have people of faith. But someone could be in a better place and I could believe it and even know it in my core and I still have got to see them go from my life. That's hard. That's a loss for me. And Elisha is seeing all this wonderful stuff, but he's still in this moment, his mentor, the man who once walked across a field that he was plowing with his team of oxen, minding his own business, and here comes this old hairy prophet coming along, throwing his cloak over his shoulders. Follow me. And he did. He left it all behind. He burned his bridges. He said goodbye to his family and friends, and he followed this man. And now he's gone. And yes, it's glorious, but yes, it's a loss. And so he's upset. Afterwards, it says in verse 13 that Elisha picked up Elijah's cloak, which had fallen when he was taken up. Then Elisha returned to the bank of the Jordan River. Now what? I got to cross the Jordan River. You know, got to find the boat to rent or got to swim really strong against the current or something. I don't know. But, you know, is God here for me too? It says he struck the water with Elijah's cloak and he cried out, "Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" And then the river divided, and Elisha went across. God says, I'm still in this thing. Verse 15 says, when the group of prophets from Jericho saw from a distance what had happened, they exclaimed, Elijah's spirit rests upon Elisha. And they went to meet him, and they bowed to the ground before him. They're not worshiping him as a man. There's a show of respect. It's like a tipping of the hat. Sir, I saw that. Like, you're the mentor now, you know? It's just, it was a special moment. They're like, wow. And before we go forward, Elijah's ministry was indeed truly remarkable from that point on. In fact, there are so many recorded stories of Elisha's ministry from this point on that more than Elijah told. In fact, some people like to make a case that Elisha did twice as many recorded miracles as Elijah did because he asked for a double share of Elijah's spirit. And that may be the case. To be honest, that's cool if it's true. I think the math's always a little funny to make that work out. You got to kind of pick and choose what you count. But, you know, that's what people do. We always make our stuff work out with our religion and our spirituality and our gamesmanship and our politics to twist everything to make it look like our views are reinforced and right. So people can make the math work that he did twice as many miracles as Elijah, but it's debatable. And that's just what's recorded. Honestly, who knows how many miracles either guy did that's not recorded in the stories. So I don't think that matters, personally. That's the kind of stuff Christians worry about too much. But I think what really is cool is that Elisha does a whole lot of awesome stuff, many more recorded miracles in his life than Elijah did. Now, was he more famous than Elijah? No way. No, he was not. Elijah's epic. Can we just be real? Elijah's so epic that there are still songs in Christian churches today that we sing about this ancient Jewish prophet sometimes in certain songs. Not often, but, you know, he'll hear his name pop up in a random song because Elijah, you know, like we were doing Passover Seder here at Good Friday, and we talked about how there's a tradition that Jewish people still observe about Elijah in that custom every year. In fact, the promise of later prophets after this of a coming front runner to the Messiah talks about coming in the spirit of Elijah. In fact, when Jesus walked this earth, he on the Mount of Transfiguration one time, he meets with Moses and Elijah with three of the disciples witnessing it. So Elijah's kind of a big deal. Elisha's never that famous. But he wasn't asking for fame. He was not asking for fortune. He is asking that God would use his life like he used Elijah's and maybe even do more things through him, not for personal fame, fortune, or glory, but for purpose and service to our Lord. And he does a lot. He does a lot of miracles. Now, we're not going to take time in our study to talk about all the miracles Elisha does. That's why I always tell you to read the scriptures for yourself. There's many that we're going to skip. We'll see a couple of them in the upcoming week or so before we get back to the Kings, because there's some neat stories there. But I'll tell you one story for today, one more story today of one of the miracles he does, and then we'll be done. In 2 Kings chapter 4 and verse 1, it says, "One day, the widow of a member of the group of prophets came to Elisha, and she cried out, 'My husband who served you is dead. And you know how he feared the Lord. But now a creditor has come threatening to take my two sons as slaves.'" We're going to talk about this verse for a few minutes here because this sets the stage for all that happens next, and I want us to think about it. It's a group of the group of the prophets. Again, this is the gathering place where all the prophets live, the little young Jedi order of prophets. Or I don't know. The gathering of the prophets all gathered together, serving. And one of them, who was part of the group, they were married. Many of them were married because they were not practicing celibacy, because most people in Jewish religion and Christian religion, some do, but most people don't observe that. They're married. He has a wife. He has kids, young kids. And he dies. He dies because people die. He dies because that's the way of life, right? Something happens and he dies. And he leaves behind, unfortunately, a wife and some young children. And as she's carrying on without him, it wasn't a great time of culture for a woman to be alive without man's help, because it was a kind of a man's world, as we've discussed so many times before. She's struggling to get by. I think the indication later is that she had liquidated all of their assets at some point to keep surviving. She borrowed money. They were in debt. At some point down the line, she's nothing else to give. They're going to take her sons as slaves. And you say, well, why would they do that? Because that's the way the world's been historically. I know we live in a very nice time period of history where you know, there's ways to get out of debt without going to jail. But that wasn't always the case. Even in recent history in the West, a couple hundred years back or a few hundred years back, people could go to debtor's prison for debts. Right? And historically, through the times of history, if you owe someone money, they could take you into slavery at certain cultures and times to work off your debt to them that you can't pay with money until it's paid off. And now you don't hear that as much anymore. Nowadays, you don't go to jail for debt, well, unless you owe the government money, in which case you're going to go to jail. That's worse than murder right there. But that's a different story. We're not going to talk about that. So anyhow, but people owing debt in those days, we'll take your sons as slaves. They're going to work. So this is a tough moment. And she comes to Elisha and she says, "Please, it's a tragic existence we are now living. Help." Elisha says to her, "What can I do to help you?" he asked. "Tell me, what do you have in the house?" I think he's asking her if she has any more valuables they can sell. Like, do you have any collector's items or valuables? Do you have a set of baseball cards or maybe prophet cards? You know, a Topps first edition Elijah rookie card autographed by the man himself. I don't know. Do you have anything valuable that you can sell that if you sell it can make some money? What do you have left in your house? And she says, "Nothing at all, except a flask of olive oil." Now, olive oil would be worth, a flask is small, just a little flask of olive oil. I can sell it for a few bucks perhaps, but I kind of need that to make our food. But that's all I have of any value. It's all gone. Elisha said to her, "Okay, here's what you're going to do." He says, "Borrow as many empty jars as you can from your friends and from your neighbors. As many jars and containers as you can come up with. Borrow them all. Then go into your house with your sons and shut the door behind you. And pour olive oil from your flask into the jars, setting each one aside when it is filled." Okay. That won't last long. If you're thinking practically, I'll pour the flask out, it'll fill the bottom of one jar and we're out. So that's the end. That's a bad idea. But I think that everyone in the story here knows this is a hearkening back to a previous miracle. that they all knew about. One that Elijah, who's now gone, Elijah in his early ministry, remember we saw the story as a young man, Elijah was sent away during the time of famine to the city of Sidon, where another single mom lived, and she was struggling to survive with her son in an economic downturn. And Elijah came to that widow, and he told her, take the bottom of the container of food that you've left, and reach down inside the bottom of that thing and make me a meal, and afterwards make one for you and your son, and God promises that you'll never run out of food in the bottom of your barrel until the whole famine's over. And one day, after miraculous day, after miraculous day at a time, that container continued to provide food for them. And that was a famous miracle that Jesus tells that story centuries later. It was passed down. So Elisha knows that story. This widow and her husband, who is a prophet, they know the story. And this sounds a lot like that. We're going to pour a flask of oil, a little flask, into jug after jug, and it's going to keep filling them up. That's what he says. So what does she do? She goes out to get her jugs, her containers, her vessels. They run outside. They start knocking on doors. They start going to their neighbors. They start going to their friends, their casual acquaintances, maybe some random strangers. Hey, please, you got some containers for us? Anything, jars, vessels of any kind, just we'll take them all. And they begin to collect and collect and collect, and they bring them all to the house. In verse 5, so she did as she was told. Her sons kept bringing jars to her, and she filled one after another, after another, after another. And soon, every container was full to the brim. Bring me another jar, she said to one of her sons. There aren't any more, he told her. And then the olive oil stopped flowing. Wow. That's pretty epic. Like, you just keep bringing another one. You keep topping them off. I think it's got how much oil's in this thing, you know? It's like, how deep is this flask? It's like, you know, some of your girls' purses, you know, just keep reaching in deeper. What's in here? I don't know. Just keeps pouring out oil and filling it up and filling another one up all the way. Every container is filled. It's a miracle. When she told the man of God, or Elisha, when she told Elisha what had happened, he said to her, okay, now sell the olive oil and pay your debts, and you and your sons can live on what is left over. He's like, start a business. Profits for, you know, olive oil. Start a storefront, build a business. Sell it anywhere you can sell it. Cater to the young people. Extra virgin olive oil. I don't know. Just get together, sell your product until it's all gone. Sell every last drop of it. And they do. And then live off the rest after you pay off all of your debts. Here's the crazy part. That worked. In fact, there's a spiritual application I'm going to give you in a moment here. Before we do, let me give you a practical thought. That's how life works. That's how hustle works. That's how financial principles work, right? That's how anything works. Like I don't have the payoff yet, but I'm going to work hard with nothing to show for it to get ready for what will happen. And I'm going to go out. Imagine that widow is sitting there as they're filling up the last jug saying, I wish we'd borrowed a few more. You know, we're going to live off the rest, you know. I just wish I'd got a few more. Should I punch a few strangers out and stole their jars? I don't know. Or maybe they're just sitting there saying, woo-hoo-hoo, I'm so thankful we did not stop when we were tired and we kept collecting more and more containers. Aren't you glad we didn't stop halfway through and say, that's probably enough. I'm tired of this. What's the point? Anyhow, it probably won't even work. They just kept going and going and going and collected all that they collected, and everything they did in preparation when the time came paid off, but only to the limit that they prepared and kept working. It's a good principle for all of life. But I want to give you a spiritual application here before we wrap this up. The spiritual application ties these two stories together. The story of Elijah and Elisha and the prophet leaving, and the story of the widow and the jugs. And here's the simple application, and I just want you to think about it with me for a few minutes. That God's power, listen, God's power is not limited to a single vessel. That he will fill as many as we make available to him. Think about that. Think about Elijah and Elisha. God's power wasn't limited to Elijah. You know, Elijah and Elisha were very different people. I mean, Elijah was, I mean, they looked different. The scriptures, for whatever reason, tells us that Elijah was a very hairy dude. And Elisha was bald, so they looked different. Their personalities and styles were different. They were just different men. Elisha could have been like, well, why bother even asking, because I'm no Elijah, you know. I mean, I'm no Elijah. Like, he's epic. They'll sing songs about him someday. I'm no Elijah. But he asked because, and God was up there saying, Elisha, I'd love to, but you're just not an Elijah. I'm looking for an Elijah. My hands are tied. Can we find another Elijah? No, God's like, I don't care. I don't care what kind of vessel, container. My power's not limited to one type of person, to one type of container. Sure. You want me to do something with your life? I can do that just as much as I can do it through Elijah. Absolutely. He'll fill as many as we make available to him. That widow kept bringing another jar. I bet you that widow had a lot of eclectic jars gathered, didn't she? A lot of eclectic. I'm sure they could. Do you have a container? Well, this one, well, that's a little, this one's small, this one's big, this one's shaped differently, this one is used for a different purpose. Will it hold olive oil? Then bring it on in. Because we're just trying to fill them up and make the sale and pay off the debt and serve the purpose. And here's the thing. None of us are like anybody else. And it's easy to get into the comparison game of saying, I wish I was more like so-and-so. I wish I was a little bit bigger capacity like so-and-so has. Or a little more gifted or shaped better or had a better use case to my gifts and talents that like so-and-so does. I just don't think I'm that special. So God's power isn't limited to a single vessel. And all of our lives, big or small, whether it's a public way or whether it's a more intimate way, we all have a sphere of influence. We all have places where we say, God, can you use me in my life to make a difference in my circle, in my workplace, in my neighborhood, with my family, with my friend circle, with my hobby group, with my faith community, or somewhere with one person? Can you let my life make an impact somewhere? Can you use me? Can you fill me? Can you do something as a willing vessel? God's like, absolutely. You're like, but I'm not like so-and-so. Who cares? He'll fill as many as we make available to him. Our job is to say, God, here I am. Here I am. I'm not bragging about it. Pretty good at self-loathing. Here I am, you know. But you can have it all. You can have it all. I don't know exactly what your purpose is for me, but I'm asking you to use me, and I'm available. We can all say that. We can all say that. In fact, a few hundred years later, Jesus would walk this earth and live and die on the cross and rise again and leave. And afterwards, the church was born in a powerful way. We'll get to those studies down the road a little bit longer. And as they do, one of the leading church voices centuries later was a man, centuries after this story today, was a man named James, who was the half-brother of Jesus. Same mama, different daddy. And James, who didn't believe on his brother most of his life, but when he saw him, his prediction come true that he was going to die and rise again, he was all in. And James became a vocal proponent of the gospel. In fact, he eventually lived and died for it, and he wrote a letter that's included in our Christian writings called the Letter of James. You talk about anybody who could feel like they're not a worthy vessel compared to their brother, you know? I mean, I am no Jesus. But James wrote a letter to the believers, and he talks about this very thing at the very end of his letter in James chapter 5. Let's look at a couple of verses and we'll be done. James 5 verse 16, he says, the earnest prayer of a righteous person has great power and it produces wonderful results. Now that's interesting, because a righteous person just means a person who's trying to do right. Doesn't mean they're perfect. No one's perfect. Righteous people mess up. We're human. We do things accidentally wrong or on purpose wrong sometimes. But what a righteous person does is when they fall, they get back up. They confess it. That very same passage, we're not looking at it, talks about confessing our faults. And so a righteous person, when they do wrong, they just own it. They confess it to God. They confess it to others if it affects them. And they say, look, I ain't perfect. I want to own that. I accept the fallout for my wrongs and my mistakes. but I'm going to keep getting back up and trying to do the right thing because I want to live the right life and be the right person best I can. And a right person, a person living the right way, that their earnest prayer has great power. It produces wonderful results. And it'd be easy to say, well, sure, James, that's easy for you to say. You don't know what it's like to feel like someone's better at that kind of stuff than you. He's like, yes, I do. Meet my brother Jesus. But you don't understand. There's all these great heroes of the faith, you know, and, you know, there's Elijah. And so James talks about that in the next verse, verse 17. He says, Elijah was as human as we are. And yet when he prayed earnestly that no rain would fall, none fell for 3.5 years. Isn't that an interesting phrase? He was as human as we are, and yet when he prayed, God used him. In fact, it says in the next verse that when he prayed again, the sky sent down rain and the earth began to yield its crops. Elijah was as human as we are. Here's the thing. It's easy to look at other people and say, I respect that person. I wish I was like that person. I respect them, but I can't relate to them. So they're just special. And you look at Elijah and say, I respect Elijah calling down fire from heaven on Mount Carmel. Those stories are so cool. I respect him, but I can't relate to him. Really? How about the other Elijah? Can you relate to Elijah when he burns out? When he abandons his co-workers and his partners and he isolates himself in the wilderness, he curls up under a tree and says, God, I just want to die. Can I just die, please? Can you relate to that, Elijah? How about the Elijah when he's so down that God takes months to get him back on track, and months later he's still repeating the mantra, I'm all alone, woe is me, no one understands, no one gets me, I'm the only one left. Is that Elijah? See, the truth is that he was as human as we are. I think that's part of why God gave him that ministry at the end with all those prophets. Think about those schools of prophets that were around. Isn't that cool? I think because there was a time when Elijah was so discouraged, he thought, I'm the only one left. He wasn't. So God says, the rest of your life, you're going to be pouring into prophets so that you'll know you're not the only one left and you have a hand in their development. That'll be good for you. But he was as human as we are. He was as vulnerable as we are. But God used him. And James was saying, that's all of us. That's what Elisha was saying when he says, listen, you're going to be gone and you're Elijah, but I'd like to have a ministry that God can use in my life as well. God's power is not limited to any single vessel. He will fill as many as we make available to him. So your job and my job today, if you ever get to those spots where you say, God, where's my place in this world? Where's my purpose? Can you use me? I'm not all that in a bag of chips, but I am what I am. Whatever I am, you can have it all, God. Here I am. You can give God one of the greatest abilities, and that's availability. I learned a long time ago in my life that there are so many people who in the realms I run in, do what I like to do and try to do much better than me. And I can't compete, and I can get discouraged by that. But I also figured out a long time ago that I can do one thing. I have one ability that no one can take away. I can be available. I can say, God, here I am. Whatever it is, it's all yours. You can do the same thing. God, use me. I want that. Make yourself available. And God will use your life in your circle, in your sphere to do something for his glory and his purposes.